Hello, I'm Fraser Myers, Deputy Editor of Spiked. I'm delighted to be joined in conversation today with Jake Waller-Simons, Editor of the Jewish Chronicle, and Brendan O'Neill, Chief Political Editor of Spiked. Today, we're going to be discussing the Israel-Hamas ceasefire deal and the release of the hostages. Jake, at the time of recording, three hostages have been released by Hamas. Do you want to give us a sense of what the reaction is like in Israel in particular?
Well, I think the predominant emotion has been joy and relief, not just amongst the families. Of course, they were overwhelmed with happiness and relief. But the country as a whole, you know, Israel is somewhere where, as you say in Hebrew, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zel Al Zeh, every person in the Israeli nation feels responsible for everybody else, feels bonded to everybody else. And that spirit of unity is really at the heart of what it means to be Israeli and what it means to be part of the astonishing success that is Israel, not just militarily or even economically or even just the fact that it exists, but also in terms of the happiness that Israelis experience. Israel is one of the happiest countries in the world despite the war. And that really comes from this strong social bond, the fact that you feel like a family, like a big family. So everybody has been hugely overwhelmed with joy as a result of seeing those three women back. And yet there are some deep concerns as well, strategically speaking, about the fact that Hamas has not yet been completely destroyed. It's been degraded by about 80%. But is that enough? You know, last March, Benny Gantz, the Israeli opposition leader, said you can't put out 80% of a fire. And that seems to be what has just happened. 80% of the fire has been put out. There's a ceasefire and nobody knows. Israel's insisting it will go back in if it needs to, but there's no real guarantee of that at the moment. And people are worried that, you know, it's all very well getting your hostages back now, but if that leads to Hamas surviving and staging another October the 7th and another one and another one, then that would be a much greater tragedy in terms of blood and lives lost that will overshadow the small victory now. So there are deep concerns as well.
Yeah, Brendan, I just wanted to ask you a little bit about the bittersweetness of the deal here, not just in terms of Hamas potentially still being active, but also what Israel is trading in order to return its hostages back. A significant number of prisoners and potentially even terrorists among them are being exchanged for civilian hostages.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, bittersweet is the right way to describe this, I think, because on the one hand, everyone is delighted to see the hostages back. Those first three hostages released is a wonderful moment for Israel and for humankind, I think. It's great that they have been released from bondage by a neo-fascist militia, which is what they've been experiencing for the past 15 months. And that's great. And no one begrudges, of course, the sheer joy that those families and Israel more broadly is feeling as a result of these three women regaining their freedom. But I do have concerns about the ceasefire deal. I have a number of concerns. I share the concern that Hamas is not fully destroyed. I'm worried about how many Palestinian prisoners Israel is returning for each hostage. 30 prisoners for every hostage or 50 for a female soldier. And some of these people are mass murderers. They are killers. They are people who have done very wicked things to the people of Israel, and they're having to be returned in order that Israel can get its citizens back. So it is bittersweet. I think there's a lot of danger in this deal. And, you know, the way I see Israel at the moment is that it is regionally in a far better position than it was 15 months ago, but globally it's in a worse position. So regionally, it has pummeled Hamas. It's really decapitated that movement, although we're not sure that Hamas is destroyed, and I'm concerned that it isn't quite destroyed. It's also pummeled Hezbollah. There have been changes in Syria that might benefit Israel, maybe. We'll see how that pans out. A lot of has changed regionally to Israel's favor precisely because of the actions that Israel has taken. But globally, as a result of that wave of Israelophobia that has swept across much of the Western world, and even the moral cowardice of globalist institutions and various governments, Israel, I fear, is a bit more isolated than it was 15 months ago. So regionally, it's stronger, but globally, it's weaker. And I think that spells dangerous times for Israel going forward.
Yeah, Jacob, we've had protests, obviously, against Israel's war against Hamas since it began. And they have even actually continued even after the ceasefire deal was struck. What does it tell you? What do those protests tell you about people's attitudes to, towards Israel in the West, in the UK? Is that a problem? I mean, there's a lot of talk there is that this deal should have come about sooner. Perhaps there should have been ceasefire on day one. What do you make of those kinds of arguments?
Well, I mean, this deal, I mean, President Biden's claimed as much credit as he could for this deal, saying that it was the same as he proposed in May, which was true, of course, and suggesting that if the deal had been signed in May, a lot of lives would have been saved. And that's certainly true as well. But at the same time, if the deal would have been done in May, Yahya Sinwar would still be alive. Rafah would not have fallen to the IDF. Ismail Haniyeh would still be alive. Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, would still be alive. Hezbollah itself, its pagers and its walkie-talkies would still be intact in the pockets of its fighters. The Iranian missile defences, which were taken out by Israel in October, would still be there. And of course, Assad, almost certainly, would still be in power. So Israel would be in a much weaker position, much, much weaker position than it currently is in. And the Ayatollah would be sitting pretty in Tehran, even today. And so all of that pressure that Israel's brought to bear on Hamas, forcing it into a position of weakness from which it's going to sign the deal, would not have happened. And the deal almost certainly would not have occurred because Hamas would still be living in the hope that the cavalry is going to come over the top of the hill from Tehran and its proxies. So I think that the idea that the deal should have been done in May is quite wrong. Israel would really be facing a very strong enemy in Hamas, as well as all the others, if that had happened. But then the question about people calling, you know, still taking to the streets of London now, even though there has been a ceasefire. I mean, Israelophobia, you know, one of its characteristics, as with classical antisemitism, is that it cloaks itself in virtue, but it doesn't take very much to peek beneath the cloak and see what's truly underneath. And these marches on the surface have claimed to be out of humanitarian concern, out of, you know, compassion and empathy for suffering Palestinians and suffering Muslims and so forth. Quite aside from the fact that they didn't show any such empathy for Muslims suffering elsewhere in Syria, in Yemen, or in China, only when the Jews are doing the killing. Setting that aside, now it's been exposed entirely because, as you said, there is a ceasefire, but they're still marching. Not only that, there was the undignified spectacle this weekend of them insisting to march past a synagogue, regardless of the fact that the police had barred them from doing so. Now, those marchers have got seven possible routes to traverse through London. Their freedom of speech is entirely protected. Two of those routes, however, go past synagogues, and those synagogues, the attendance has gone down by 50%. The places have been spat at, had Palestinian flags draped over them. One of them was besieged for a while by a mob before the police managed to move them on. This is not pleasant. This is infringing Jewish rights just to simply live as a Jewish family, go to your place of worship and live normally. The police barred the marchers from going past those synagogues, and that was too much for them. They mounted this huge, furious protest in response. And so this really reveals the true motivation at the heart of these marches, which is that it's not about Palestinians, it's not about suffering or humanitarian concern, it's not even about Israel, it's about the Jews.
Now, Brendan, it's obviously fantastic news to see the release of the first few hostages, but it struck me that their plight has been rather ignored throughout this war. I bet there's a lot of people in Britain who don't even know that a British citizen has been held captive for more than 470 days in Gaza. I bet a lot of people have never even heard of or know the name Emily Damari. I mean, what do you make of that? What does that tell us about how people have seen this conflict?
Yeah, it's really shocking. I've been thinking about that a lot over the past few weeks, in fact, and few months. Whenever Emily Damari's name comes up, I think to myself, I wonder how many British people know this name. I wonder how many people are aware of the predicament she found herself in for 15 months. You know, this is a British Jew, a British Israeli woman, a young woman who was kidnapped and held captive by an army of anti-Semites, by a virulently racist militia. And they kidnapped her for the crime of being a Jew. And in the past, left-wingers and progressives might have protested about something like that. They might have held vigils for this person. They might have condemned the neo-fascists who kidnapped her and held her in what we presume were awful conditions. And yet that didn't happen. There have been lots of vigils for Emily Damari, held by the Jewish community and supporters of Spurs, because she's a supporter of Spurs as well, and supporters of Arsenal. You know, it's fallen to football fans to try to raise awareness of Emily Damari because the left and progressives and so-called anti-fascists were not interested. And I think this raises a really important question, because even though I think everyone is happy, of course, that the hostages are coming home, and everyone's happy that the war has been halted for a period of time, no one wants this war. This war is awful, this war that Hamas started on 7th of October 2023. It's good that there is a break in the war and that some people will find some element of peace and we might work out a route forward. That's all to the good, I think. However, we cannot forget what happened over the past 15 months. We absolutely cannot forget that when these women and others were kidnapped by a neo-fascist militia, many people in the West took the side of their kidnappers. Many people in the West supported Hamas. They expressed support for Hamas. They went on the streets. They sang the praises of the Houthi movement, which says a curse upon the Jews on its actual flag. They sang the praises of Hezbollah, an anti-Semitic movement that says it wants to excise the cancer of Zionism from the Middle East. They supported the anti-Semites on Israel's border rather than Israel itself. And the reason we can't forget that is because it was such a revealing moment in the 21st century West. It really confirmed how severe the crisis of civilization has become, how far down the well of moral relativism and even moral decay significant sections of our society have fallen. And if we forget that, we will not make this situation any better. So even as the crisis in the Middle East resolves itself, which it might and it might not, we need to have a reckoning here in the West as to how all this happened, as to why people don't know the name Emily Damari, and as to why so many of them took the side of her oppressors rather than her. That's the discussion we need to have going ahead.
And Jake, every time the ceasefire deal is discussed on the news, the word keeps coming up, fragile. It's a fragile piece. We're still only at the first stage of the agreement that's being implemented. There are two more stages left to go. What are the possible risks, do you think? How high is the risk of things unraveling and turning nasty again?
I think it is fragile. I think the risk is quite high of it collapsing. Of course, it is supposed to be a three-phase deal, but only the first phase has actually been agreed. The other two phases have not been signed yet. And even within this first phase, there's many steps to go through, and Hamas are nothing if not tricksy. And as we've seen with their brinkmanship of not even releasing the names until the deadline had gone, they don't want to play ball by nature. They want to be as disruptive as possible and use every psychological lever they can over the Israeli people. But the first phase itself is complicated enough. We've got these three women who have been let out already in return for 90 prisoners. And then every week over the next five further weeks, more hostages will be released. There's four next week, three, then finally 14. The final group of hostages are likely to be bodies, dead bodies, sadly. Israel prioritizing the living hostages, of course. And of course, Israel is also prioritizing women, children, and the elderly. One question that's hanging over this is what's happened to the Bibas children, those twins or children with ginger hair that caught the imagination of the world. They weren't let out in the first batch, suggesting they might be dead, as Hamas suggested last year, but still Israel hasn't confirmed that. Hamas, in return, has reversed the priority. So they want to have their most serious murderers and terrorists out first, and the women and children last, rather revealing about their opposite way of seeing the world that privileges death above life, whereas Israelis see things the opposite way around. There's lots that can go wrong there. We haven't even started to talk about the Israeli troop movements. Israel is planning to withdraw from the Netzarim corridor, which bisects the middle of the Gaza Strip, allowing a million people to surge back north and once again take up positions in some close proximity to the Israeli communities on the other side of the fence. That's a problem. Israel is going to partially withdraw from the Philadelphia corridor, where the smuggling from Egypt to Gaza takes place. That's difficult as well. Israel is going to be suspending a lot of surveillance from the air of Gaza. So again, blinkering its own intelligence with regard to Hamas's further movements. So there's a lot here that could go wrong. And then Negotiations for phase two will begin in the middle of this. And phase two is going to be the release, hopefully, we think, of male hostages in return for more prisoners, a final troop withdrawal by Israel. And then phase three will be reconstruction of Gaza. So if all this goes ahead, it is designed to lead to a complete end to the war, which is what Hamas very much wants. From the Israeli point of view, Netanyahu has insisted it won't mean an end to the war. Israel wants to retain the right to go back in and finish what it started. And President Trump has appeared to support that point of view as well. So it seems unlikely that this deal will last all the way through the three phases to reconstruction. But, you know, it really is too early to say.
Brendan, finally, we've seen images for the first time in a while of Hamas militants out and about as they were returning the hostages. For a lot of this war, if you followed the Western media, you'd have thought that Israel is fighting purely against civilians or is fighting an almost shadow enemy. What do you think it tells us, the fact that Hamas operatives clearly feel emboldened to come out and show themselves now in a way that they haven't over the past few years?
Yeah, the media coverage of this war, I think it's the worst media coverage I've seen of any event in recent times. It's been so shockingly bad, and they so often invisibilize Hamas. They just don't tell us that they're there. They don't show them in the news reports. It's never really clear why Israel is in Gaza, what the IDF troops are shooting at, why they're attacking hospitals and schools. And the reason they're doing that is because Hamas holds itself up in those places and uses those as places from which to attack the IDF, which is a war crime, as everyone is well aware. But we're given so little information. We're not given the whole picture. And if you watch the BBC coverage, especially journalists like Fergal Keane, all you get are these extraordinarily manipulative, emotionalist accounts of suffering in a Palestinian family, for example. No context is given, no reason is given for why these events are taking place. No war context is provided. And it just leaves people uninformed. It's really a dangerous form of coverage. The fact that Hamas militants have come out from their tunnels and were in the streets celebrating this ceasefire and are now involved in the handover of the hostages, although, as Jake says, it's kind of slightly blown out of proportion. They aren't as numerous as people might think. But that is a confirmation they are still there, and Israel is not fighting against ghosts. It's fighting against a real army of anti-Semites that threatens the very existence of the Jewish state. And I think that's something worth bearing in mind as we move forward. You know, this is an awful war, and it's one of the reasons some of us really hate Hamas is because they started this awful war by invading Israel and killing 1,200 of its people. And it will be good if this war comes to an end, but we do have to say out loud, I think, that the destruction of Hamas remains a noble goal. It remains a noble and important goal. It will make Israel safer, and it will benefit the world as well if this regressive Islamist army is wiped out. And a lot of people in the West now, a lot of leftists are saying, well, you can't kill an idea, you can't destroy an idea. And without wanting to get into historical relativism, you do have to wonder, would they have said the same thing in the battle against fascism? Would they have said, well, you can't kill an idea like fascism, you can't just get rid of it? The truth is that Israel has every right to fight against Hamas. The best outcome in this war would be the destruction of Hamas, because that would improve the security of the world's only Jewish nation, and it would set back the cause of Islamist tyranny even further, and that would benefit all human beings.
Jake, your final thought, please.
If you think back to 2014, to the war between Israel and Hamas then, journalists were allowed into the Strip to cover it, but all of them were given Hamas minders. And as a result, the footage that came out didn't show any Hamas fighters, no dead or wounded terrorists, only suffering civilians, because that was the image that Hamas wished to craft for the consumption of the world, to give the impression that Israel was only killing civilians. And there was one moment, I don't know if you recall this, but an Indian film crew was at their hotel, looked out the window and saw some Hamas members preparing to fire a rocket from just outside their hotel within a densely populated civilian area, filmed it, broadcast it, and it made a sensation because it was the one and only time anybody had ever caught them actually fighting. And Hamas were very cross about that. Fast forward to today, Israel's taken the step of not allowing journalists into Gaza, partly, I think, to prevent this sort of propaganda going out. But they haven't managed to prevent it, because instead, the media is simply taking footage filmed by people inside Gaza and using that instead. Now, that footage is equally censored by Hamas. Nothing comes out of Gaza without being censored by Hamas, or the people who shot it will be killed. And so the media, the BBC and other outlets, are taking this censored footage and broadcasting it to their hundreds of millions of viewers en masse, stamped with the legitimacy of international broadcasting corporations like the BBC and others, without giving people a health warning that this is censored propaganda footage. Now, the very most obvious thing that the BBC, for example, should do whenever broadcasting footage from Gaza is to say, just to let you know, viewers, be aware, the following footage has been censored by Hamas. Here you go. And the full picture is that half of the people who have been killed are combatants and there aren't as many civilians and not as many children and so on and so forth. But instead, the media has acted as a huge megaphone for Hamas propaganda. And it is, as Brendan said, the most shameful chapter in the history of journalism.
Jake, Brendan, thank you very much.